The first time I heard Devo was in a dance concert by two New York City choreographers who had come to teach a semester of dance at Interlochen. I was a sophomore in high school, and it was too early in my dance career to be taking classes from the guests. But I was already deeply involved in the dance department as my mother was on the faculty, and as I had been doing tech work for the concerts and tours, and as the dancers had always been among my best friends. At that time and place, like a lot of different times and places, New York City was the shit. It was the inevitable, enviable center of the universe, the pot at the end of the rainbow, the point where all roads lead and from which all that mattered flowed. It was everything that where I lived wasn't. It was big, it was exciting, it was urban, it was dangerous, and it was open all night. Interlochen was a blessed oasis in the cultural desert of rural Michigan, but no matter how many student art shows and student theater productions and student recitals one went to, there was no escaping from the fact that we were, after all, in the middle of nowhere, and the art was by students, no matter how gifted. Many of us already knew that we would end up in New York City sooner or later, but we weren't there yet, so anybody who was already living in that Shangri-La was held in the highest regard. So I went to the concert, and I remember absolutely nothing about it, except that the last piece used some contemporary music that absolutely blew my mind. I had just recently waded into the murky waters of popular music, and although there was a lot of music I liked well enough, there was precious little that really spoke to me. I started enthusiastically listening to the radio along with everybody else during my first summer job in the local cafeteria, and I would always look forward to Sunday's walk through the Garden of Hits with Casey Kasem, but I knew there was more going on than I was allowed to hear. I could see it in the local record stores, as provincial as they were. There were a couple of racks at the back of Midnight Records that held imports. And I knew from just looking at these strange and wondrous covers that they contained unimagined sonic treasures that were never going to hit the holy American Top 40. Unfortunately, they also sported exotic price tags, so I contented myself with spending my monthly allowance, which was $10, devised so I could go to the movies once a week if I so chose, but I always chose to spend the entire amount on a record about 2 days into the months, on domestic releases that I knew I would like, such as Synergy and Tangerine Dream and Vangelis and Jean-Michel Jarre, records that had long ago branded me as a musical oddity among my local friends, who mostly favored the Electric Light Orchestra, ABBA, Kris Kristofferson, and the soundtrack from Grease. But sitting there in the darkness, watching these two cool dancers from New York City writhe through their postmodern ode to urban angst, or whatever the hell it was they were doing, I had my head split open by the strange, angular music on the soundtrack. The last two songs were awkward and frightening and dark and exciting and spoke of the city and alienation and strange situations undreamt of in the cold, dark woods of the North. The rhythms lurched and stumbled and banged into each other. The vocals were shrill and harsh. The lyrics were unsettling. The electronic textures were creepy and surreal and wholly unnatural, and I was completely enthralled.
Take long.
I certainly never heard such poisonous incense coming out of my radio, and I knew I never would. But I also knew that someday I would find music like this for myself. The pieces weren't listed on the program, and I never asked the two women who had performed them what they were, being somewhat shy, and also liking to do things entirely on my own from a very early age. But I carried the memories of those songs in my heart as my own private talisman of coolness, confident that someday I would not only find this music, but I would make it my own. Someday, I would be that cool. Almost exactly a year later, I stumbled across both pieces again. One of them, it turned out, was by Lena Lovitch, and was called You Can't Kill Me, lent to me by a compassionate acquaintance. The other I rediscovered while looking through the racks of a record store in St. Louis. I had heard some rumblings about this weird band out of Ohio called Devo, and was looking through their releases. Their third record, Freedom of Choice, was starting to get a little airplay with a catchy and soon-to-be-defining Whip It. And there, listed as the last track on the first album, was the other missing piece, Shrivel Up. I bought the record on the spot, and I took it back to my dad's apartment. I was visiting my dad for spring break. We used to get 3 weeks off at Christmas and during the spring, and I had planned to spend the whole time with him in St. Louis, where he had recently moved. The first week went swimmingly, but then the tension started rising. It was a small apartment, one room really, and we both shared the fold-out couch, and the longer I was there, the smaller it got. He was full of plans for me to move there and spend my senior year in St. Louis, and I was full of plans for me not to do that. I hadn't spent 3 years building up my friends and reputation at Interlochen to throw it away and become some anonymous geek in some urban high school in St. Louis for my last year. I had done a lot of work and was ready to reap my rewards. He argued that I would just be a big fish in a small pond, and wouldn't it be great to get out and swim the ocean with the sharks? He argued passionately about how exciting it would be when we could live together and I could get a job at McDonald's, and here's an application. And it just didn't matter. There was no way I was going to leave Interlochen before graduation, and I told him so. He dropped it, but I could tell he was disappointed and pissed. Apartment got smaller and smaller. We spent every waking and sleeping moment together. I was taking dance class from him every day, so I didn't even get a break when he had to go to work. I knew what I had to do, but I dreaded doing it. Halfway through the second week, I screwed up my courage and I told him I wanted to go home early, that I needed a little time and space to myself, that I had spent all year living with a roommate, and that I had a lot of homework I needed to do, and that even though this trip had been great and it was wonderful to spend time with him, I really just wanted a few days to myself before the last hectic spring term began. And that was it. I had set off the bomb. He took this request, along with my unwillingness to drop my life and join his, as a rejection of him. which, to some degree, I suppose it was. And we got into the worst fight of our lives. There was lots of screaming and slamming and stomping around, but I held on tenaciously, determined to stick to my guns. Wounded, and in need to hurt me back, my father found a bomb of his own to drop, one that he hoped would kill me. He told me that I wasn't his son. The shockwaves crashed through that tiny apartment and knocked my knees out from under me, but it hadn't worked. I knew he was lying. The bomb he dropped hadn't killed me. It had killed him. My father was buried in the rubble, and now, before me, stood a poor, lonely, weak old man. I had won. Hooray. In the morning, we stopped at a travel agent to change my ticket. Now knowing that I was going home in a day instead of a week made everything suddenly bearable. If I could just get through the next 24 hours, I would be all right. But boy, was it a long 24 hours. He moped and grumbled. He conspicuously tore up the schedule for the next week we had made and the application for McDonald's I had begrudgingly filled out. He slept on the floor that night, I come by my martyrishness honestly, and in the morning we walked silently over to the dance studio where he worked, he with his hands buried in his pockets and a deep frown carved into his face, me desperately clutching my new record. He had some errand to run and no turntable in his apartment, so he was going to unlock the studio for me, and then he'd come pick me up again later. I sat in the quiet calm of the empty dance studio, a primal place of comfort for a child of dancers, and slipped my new record from its sleeve and set it on the turntable. I picked up the tone arm, flicked the ball of dust off the end of the stylus with my finger, and set the needle into the groove. I had never heard anything like this. Everything was wrong. The music lurched and stumbled around. The lyrics were absurd and unsettling. The guitars clashed and crashed. These guys were about as far from cool as you could be. They were not only awkward, they were actually celebrating their awkwardness. The inner sleeve showed inscrutable pictures of men in diapers or wearing plastic heads or working in some nameless factory. The band was ugly in their plastic yellow jumpsuits, and so unconcerned with the conventions of fame that they didn't even have last names, just Mark and Alan and Jerry and Bob 1 and Bob 2. I knew I had entered some alternate universe, and I felt like I had come home. The music sounded like how I felt, jerky and confused and too smart and too stupid, all rolled into one big, bitter adolescent ball, careening wildly around a pinball table, crashing into bumpers and lighting up lights. I was not cool, I was not popular, and I was not willing to just take what was given to me, and Devo wrapped me in its fake plastic arms and let me know that I wasn't alone. they weren't popular either, and they were proud of it, and their unspeakable deconstruction of one of the primary icons of the rock and roll myth, the Rolling Stones' immortal and immoral satisfaction, warmed me to my very core. Eventually, I got to the moment I had been waiting for, the last song, the song I had first heard a year earlier in that dark dance performance, Shrivel Up. I listened to the song slip into its inexorable downward spiral and stared at the cover and thought about all that had happened in the last couple of days. And from the cover stared a generic white dad in a suburban hat with the words "actual size" stamped across him, even though he was smaller than actual size. Behind him, filling up the entire cover, was an iconic golf ball, and scrawled across the top in purple crayon the question, "Are we not men?"
Shrivel up.
When the record ended, I picked up the needle and cued the last track again and again. I kept listening to it while staring at the cover. I was still listening to that track when I heard my dad walk into the room. I could feel him staring at me, but I didn't look up from the record. After a moment, he walked back out of the room and slammed the door and was gone. Are we not men? We are Devo. After this, I became a big Devo fan, and quickly went out and bought their other two records, Duty Now for the Future and Freedom of Choice, and I started unraveling the Devo story.
Warning! This is an illegal assembly! Disperse!
Devo, as it turns out, was formed by two disillusioned college students at Kent State who had witnessed the National Guard's murder of student protesters.
Oh!
Devo is short for de-evolution, the idea that we have passed our peak as a species and have started to sink back towards the primordial goo from whence we came. Now that we have more or less conquered natural selection, we are encouraging stupidity by not letting it die off, and we are polluting the species just as much as we are polluting the planet.
Send those hippies straight to hell.
Now, I know these are dangerous concepts to bandy about, and it was just such a road that the National Socialists started walking down in the 1930s, but Devo is less of an instigator than a chronicler. After all, instigating would be far too proactive for a band like Devo. They just want to point out how far we've fallen while simultaneously celebrating and condemning our fall from grace. And besides, they're not saying one race is weaker than the other. Everybody is suspect. We're all Devo, they cheerfully taunt. Don't be ashamed of your heritage. Grab another beer and sit back there on the couch, you big spud, you beautiful mutant. Three cheers for mediocrity and alienation. Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray! Hip hip hooray! Although they started as a guitar band, they quickly realized the potential of synthesizers to bolster up their cause and to suck the soul out of their music, soul being so Evo. And by their third and most popular album, Freedom of Choice, they were almost entirely synthetic. Although it may lack the apocalyptic vision of the first album, and really, what could be more de-evolutionary than having each new record be slightly less interesting and adventurous than the one before, Freedom of Choice is what most people hear in their heads when they think of Devo, especially for that dance-friendly hit, Whip It. Although not the best song in the repertoire, Whip It is notable because it's on that hit that Devo finally had the courage to completely devolve the very notion of a solo. In the center of the song, where the guitar solo usually goes, sits the perfect Devo deconstruction. One note, repeated with perfect clockwork regularity, at the beginning of each measure for eight measures, while the drums continue beating out the lockstep rhythms with no flashy fills whatsoever. So uncool. Good. Eventually, Devo even managed to dip below my radar, becoming so devolved as to become a tired cliché, but they did rack up an impressive catalog of stunning tributes to our decaying society in the 20 years they were together. And although I never had the pleasure, they were supposed to be a phenomenal live band, stumbling around in their flowerpot hats. But for me, Devo will always be that moment, sitting in the empty dance studio, staring at the cover of their first album, and listening to the man who was my father storm out and slam the door.
You gotta buy a sack.